Welcome to the OIS Podcast, where you get candid conversations with the leaders and drivers of ophthalmic innovation. And now, here's our host, Tom Salemi.
All right, welcome back. This is Tom Salemi, and I am the host of the OIS Podcast. Thank you for joining us again today to hear another tale of innovation. One of the more interesting deals of the year had been Allergan's acquisition of Oculive. Oculive is a very early stage company. Its device to treat dry eye isn't even commercial yet, and the company itself is only a few years old. Yet Allergan, the new Allergan that was formerly Actavis, made Oculive its first big play in medtech. It takes a special kind of company to be bought out that quickly, and Oculive is one of those many special companies to be brought out of the Stanford Biodesign Group. So today, we wanted to delve a little deeper into its origins and into Stanford Biodesign by talking to one of its co-founders, Josh Macauer. Josh is co-founder, again, of the Stanford Biodesign Group. He's also created the ExploraMed Incubator, which produced companies like Acclarent. And he's now a partner at NEA, the venture firm, which just closed on over $3 billion in new capital. Macauer has spent his life innovating. He joined Pfizer right after med school, and he set a course on a career in medtech creation. So today, we'll talk about his history, his passions, and his outlook for the medtech industry, including ophthalmology. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Josh Macauer, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Tom. Great to be here.
So explain something. This is kind of off topic, but you're obviously a technology guy, medtech, and you literally wrote the book on medtech. Why don't medtechers tweet? This is, again, off topic, but I'm tweeting out there. Yeah. I'm trying to get out there, but medtechers don't tweet for some example. You have something like, for some reason, you have 252 followers. I mean, you're a main guy in medtech, and no one's listening to you. And to be fair, you haven't really said much for a couple of years, so... Why aren't medtechers out there?
Interestingly, I have over 700 followers on my Coravin identity, and I have a few identities on Twitter. Tweeting is a lot more of a consumer outreach type of media, at least from my perspective. Obviously, there are those that are trying to promote themselves and the brand and so on, and that's absolutely necessary when you're a consumer focused person. But, you know, medtech is really focused to a much more tighter set of customers. You know, usually medtech is focused mostly on physicians, maybe the colleagues, but, you know, it just doesn't connect directly to our world as much as consumer does. And I think you'll see, as we develop more med consumer projects, you'll see a lot more tweeting going on. But really from those that have the authenticity and are central to whatever that project or that theme is. So it'll be, you know, in my Coravin identity is all about wine and all about that technology and our customers and, you know, what they care about, and doesn't, you know, cross over much into any other spaces. And I think similarly, back in the day, I was exploring tweeting when we were, you know, sort of engaged in the, you know, sort of the FDA reform discussions. And I thought that that would be an important outlet, but I didn't do much of it. And honestly, I don't know. It just, some of it felt a little bit more self-promotional and just not into that. So it didn't really resonate too much with me. But on the Coravin side, it's completely natural because we're actually trying to drive utilization and awareness of a product that does something really unique, and consumers want to find out about it, and that's a great way to sort of get the word out.
Oh, I am all about self-promotion, so that must be why I'm out there. What, Coravin, is that counted as a drug delivery device? If anyone doesn't know what it is, it's a real fascinating little tool.
Yeah, it's a great technology. It's a way to take wine out of a bottle without ever exposing the wine in the bottle to air. So if you're a wine lover and you every so often just want to have a glass, this is a great technology because you can have a great glass of a great bottle and not worry about what's left in the bottle ever spoiling. And so, This is a technology that is invented by my buddy Greg Lambrecht, and we co-founded this company about 4 years ago, and it's doing fantastically. You'll find it this Christmas and most, or this holiday season in most outlets across the country and really world. You know, we're a global business and growing rapidly, and it's becoming a core tool for the wine industry. And the way I include it in my portfolio of projects that I've worked on it and make it consistent is it's all about quality of life. And so Coravin is a product that greatly improves your quality of life if you are a wine lover. And so, therefore, it's a fitting investment of my time.
So this NEA job that you took, this is just to pay the Coravin bills? Is that the deal?
That's right. Exactly. That's all it is.
Well, let's hop into that. We'll get into your background in a bit, but you've joined NAA. You've obviously been working with them for close to 2 decades, if not 2 decades, as part of ExploraMed. Yes. But what made you sort of put on the suit and the fancy clothes of a VC rather than the overalls or whatever you wore in your little workshop in Stanford?
Right. Well, I'm actually wearing jeans right now. They're black jeans, so you can't tell that they're actually jeans. So I've got a way to morph my entrepreneurial behaviors into the VC world.
Don't let them break you, Josh. Keep true to yourself.
I've had to wear a collared shirt a lot more than I have over the last couple of years. A T-shirt doesn't always fly around here. I have been working with NEA for 20 years, as you mentioned, and really respect the organization. And obviously, NEA has a tremendous reputation and a position in the marketplace and ability to really move and make a real change. And I've always wanted to make a major impact in wherever I spent my time. And, you know, I couldn't think of a better place than NEA to continue to do that. They've been my financial partner for all these years, and I really credit NEA and, you know, John Neera and Ryan and others, Ryan Durant and others to my success in supporting the things that we were doing, albeit risky. And a lot of those paid off. And I think as a result, that's probably what gave me the opportunity to move here at NEA. And I think the platform opportunity and the fact that NEA is still very strongly in support of funding and being a part of the med tech investing community is a perfectly great place for me to transition to the next step in my career. And I was really looking to do something just a little bit different. And honestly, it is just a little bit different. You know, I still, you know, in my role, although I am an inventor and, you know, a founder and, you know, played, you know, a role in getting things started, a lot of the job, you know, those were fleeting opportunities when we were getting things together, but a lot of the remaining job was working with the CEOs and leaders of those businesses and being a good board member and a part of the team and helping to advance those projects in any way that I could with utilizing whatever background or, you know, capabilities I had to benefit the business. And so I see myself doing is still that in companies that we would back. So I'm feeling that there's a lot of compatible and very similar skill sets that I'm applying here as I would apply in my previous role as an incubator leader. And actually, we'll continue to do new projects through the incubator. I'm working on trying to pull ExploraMed into and under the NEA umbrella for it to be a place where I can work with you know, young or early entrepreneurs with ideas and or not even ideas yet, but just great people who have a high probability of creating something awesome. And putting them into the ExploraMed structure and allowing that to be a tool to allow us to, you know, create new businesses through. So that we're still going to do work through ExploraMed, but obviously a majority of my time will be spent looking at new projects, both large and small, and investing in them.
Do you think you could really get into a late stage deal? Really find that interesting?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think what matters to me is it really has to be something that is novel and making a big difference. And, you know, I think the tougher needle to thread is, you know, does it meet the financial criteria that NEA is looking for returns? And so, you know, there's a lot of things that we won't do, both small and large. But I think that there's so much to be done in healthcare and so much need. And really, there's so much innovation. I'm particularly excited about the innovation in the consumer you know, oriented spaces and, you know, health IT and device enabled services, you know, sort of new concepts of devices that enable new ways of treating patients and reducing the cost of care and improving outcomes. There's so much tremendous things to do there, and that's going to really be exciting. So I'm excited about playing a role in advancing those therapies, you know, through the investment activity at NEA.
So I hear those areas, and I don't know, maybe I'm just being overly trained to look for buzzwords, but it sounds like you're going to do less pure med tech that you've done before and look more into those areas where med tech enables other types of industries as opposed to investing in a new implantable whatnot or some traditional med tech technology?
No, we'll still look, and we will probably invest in, and we just have actually, you know, NEA has just, you know, made an investment in traditional med tech firm in the peripheral vascular space. Mm-hmm. And so we will continue to do those deals, but the criteria is different than it was 10 or 15 years ago. The world has changed. We're not going to get paid for, you know, we're not going to get paid a bigger price for something that just improves the quality of care anymore. We actually need to reduce costs as well. And that's, you know, that used to be an analysis that was sort of secondary, and now it's probably primary. It probably has to reduce costs as a primary objective, and then secondarily also improve outcomes as sort of the way that the world is working with reimbursement. And that is the major front right now that is limiting the growth of med tech is reimbursement. So, you know, recognizing that, I think we're going to use a little bit of a finer filter on the projects that we would get behind, but I think there's still a lot of opportunity in traditional medical devices that has the capacity to achieve those goals. So absolutely we'll be participating and investing in traditional medical devices going forward, along with some of this new, the new era of device technology, which I think is being born, which is in the consumer health tech space.
I'd like to pause this conversation. Kids don't say timeout anymore. They say pause. For a moment to remind everyone who's listening that if they have a tale of innovation they feel is worth sharing to over 800 of the more influential key opinion leaders, entrepreneurs, and investors in ophthalmology, then they should go to OIS.net, fill out an application for presenting companies, and tell your company's story to our OIS audience. And I know when you were exploring Med, you were looking at consumer opportunities. We had Bill Facto at the conference a few months back, and he explained that during his time at Exploring Med with you, you were looking in that area. But I was thinking more. I know NEA will invest in devices, but you have been on the front lines of pushing back against the FDA, pushing for reimbursement, naming names of insurers who you think haven't treated med tech fairly. Is this I hear you talk today, and you're looking at all these other areas. Is this a sign that the battle's not going well, or do you see some areas of improvement in those in those spaces? You know, with the FDA, is our reviews getting easier? Is reimbursement getting easier? What's your state of the med tech industry?
Everything that I hear and I've also experienced with the FDA is so much better than it was back in 2010 when we began our advocacy effort to try to make changes. I mean, Jeff Shuren has done a fantastic job in really balancing the risk and benefit. And what we were all getting hung up on and was that, you know, the review teams were sort of spiraling downward down these theoretical pathways that were not reasons to delay further investigation, not reasons to delay IDEs, and really not reasons to delay approvals, because they were all theoretical risks. And not all. Obviously, there were still a lot of things that were rejecting that deserved to be rejected. And I'm not saying that everything that was put in front of the agency over that time frame was worthy of moving forward, but it did feel to those of us deeply in the field that there was a lot that was facing amazing roadblocks and delays at great cost that was not appropriate. And I think that while initially the position was that it was the quality submissions and all that, that was the industry had lost its way in terms of all of those aspects. I think that the truth ultimately got borne out through studies that, you know, we did, as well as others, validated through, repeating those studies in different methodologies, you know, basically showed that, no, this is a gross problem that is moving in the wrong direction. And if we want to preserve innovation in the United States and really our industry and really the ability to advance new therapies for patients in the device arena, we've got to do something, and we've got to do it quick. We definitely did something, and I think the FDA has really responded in a very positive way, in a balanced way. It still is not – there's nothing easy about moving a project through the FDA right now. But it does feel like it's a much more fair and balanced conversation, and much more focused on the right risks, as I'm being told by many fellow entrepreneurs and company leaders. It does feel a lot better. The tone of the conversation's better. There's a lot more dialogue around the right issues, and that's what's important. The right things will move forward, and the things that don't, you know, that should not move forward won't, and that's the way it should be. But at least we're going to see some more innovation coming out. And I see the numbers of approvals and the numbers of applications that are being accepted for IDE, I think, is a very positive sign. So there's big changes there. The big problem that we still face, and that honestly has been very tough to get our fingers around because of the industry itself, is there isn't what the nice thing about FDA, good and bad, was that it was one big governmental agency, and they were controlled by Congress, and therefore there were people who one could complain to ask for change, and it really a requirement that those concerns at least need to be listened to alongside, you know, the alternative opinion point of view as well, and hopefully some balanced process could result that would lead us to something that would be much more beneficial for the citizens of the United States. Whereas when it comes to the insurers, you know, you have so many different participants in this space, and many of them are profit motivated. They're not, you know, government agencies solely set up to service the population, and there isn't a central place to go complain. And many of the private insurers don't really want to hear the complaints, and, you know, certainly wouldn't want to hear it from industry. So therefore, we have a much more challenging road ahead to figure out how we advance new therapies and get them paid for. And, you know, we're seeing it now with the companies that I'm affiliated with that have new products that even have a great code with the CPT-1 approval and a great payment assigned through that process. And then yet still we're arm wrestling every individual insurance company trying to get the same treatment, and it's not this. It's very difficult, and very time-consuming, and very expensive. So, I don't know how we get out of that box, but it is a issue that we have. Perhaps on some domains of healthcare, where it's a life or death situation, and there really is there really is a dire consequence by an insurer not paying for something, I think there's probably more likelihood to pay, and therefore, you know, things like orphan diseases and other, you know, sort of more biotech-oriented projects are getting, you know, a lot of support with a lot more dollars than medical devices would ever ask for. But unfortunately, a lot of our projects, you know, really relate to, you know, more modest quality of life improvements that, you know, are really meaningful on an individual basis, but, you know, no one's going to die. And so I think some of that is frustratingly diminished in their eyes, and therefore, you know, face much more significant hurdles in trying to get medical directors to get behind some new technologies, looking for, you know, the next study and the next study. And it's not clear whether they really are looking for studies or whether it's just a delaying tactic, you know, to try to see whether there'd be enough of an uprising amongst the participants that they'd see people leaving because they aren't, you know, going to have this or that, you know, singular therapy to a different insurer. I don't know, but that is our big, that's, if there is one big issue looming over med tech right now, it's probably reimbursement.
Mm-hmm. And you had identified in some interview, I forget where, WellPoint as a troublesome entity, but then you also said that other insurers were there as well, and that actually, I'm reading Stephen Brill's book, and WellPoint is featured prominently there. So it was a great point by you. What led you to sort of assume this mantle? I mean, you were out there, you did surveys, you were obviously testifying before Congress, you and Mike Carusi was out there, but what led you to sort of take the charge? You were out there in the streets really pushing back hard.
Yeah, I was, and really, you know, still am. I mean, at that point in time, there was a real call for action. I mean, I've spent my whole career focused on creating technologies to improve human health, and I was very fortunate to have a couple of successes that provided me with the ability to say, you know, maybe it's time to give back and take some personal risk and really advocate on behalf of the industry, because I saw so many colleagues who had all these same concerns as I did, but for one reason or another just could not, you know, their boards or their investors or their, you know, they were too afraid of repercussions or backlash or, you know, sort of, you know, some of that happening as a result of speaking out. And so I was sort of just in a place where I felt like I could do it, and it was a responsibility that I needed to listen to, and so I went ahead. It's not my nature to go pick a fight, but this was, you know, I was really, really fighting on behalf of all our colleagues who were suffering, and really for the patients that were being denied the opportunity to ever see even the chance to have a technology that would improve their health. You know, and there was so much risk, and unfortunately, it didn't happen fast enough, and we're still seeing the fallout from those years is still happening. You know, the VCs have departed, many of them, many businesses have failed or, you know, been sold for nothing and thus generating no returns, and therefore LPs of VCs are saying, why are we investing in medtech, and all that kind of stuff has happened. And I don't think it's over. There's probably a couple other, you know, firms to exit, you know, medtech investing coming soon and in the next years ahead. But, you know, there's a few residual survivors and strong believers, and I do think that, you know, there's going to be a rebirth, and this whole field is going to come back together. But we've been irreparably damaged by, you know, that period of time, and, you know, hopefully the stuff that I did and that my colleagues and I did, you know, helped stop it from being completely wiped out, but we couldn't prevent some of the damage that has occurred regardless of the improvements that we actually did make.
Yeah, it's an unscientific sampling, but we actually had a really strong showing at our MedTech conference in May. Justin Klein, your colleague, is a co-chair of that event, and there was a lot of energy and positive feelings, but you're right. You look at the numbers and the population of people who are committing capital, at least your traditional VCs, and it seems to be shrinking. Did you get any kind of repercussions or blowback from your very public stance?
I really don't think so. I think that, look, initially, you know, there was a little bit of tension between Jeff and I, you know, on stage and in front of Congress and all of that. But I think, you know, as the dust has settled, and I really tried very, very hard throughout that whole process, and it was never about accusing any individuals or even accusing anyone at the FDA of, you know, doing anything wrong. It was more of a pointing to that, look, the system is broken and we need to fix it because we're hurting innovation, and that's what the spotlight that I was trying to pull on that issue is innovation and the next generation therapies that are absolutely needed and so important are being threatened by all this that's going on. So, you know, it's too much. We need to be balanced. We need to allow the good things to progress, and good things are dying right now. And that was really the central theme. And I think as the dust has settled, I feel like even people who might have thought that I was, you know, being aggressive, I've realized that, you know, a lot of what I was saying was right, and it's been validated. And I think major changes have occurred as a result, and I think we're seeing some positive evidence that we're moving in the right direction again. I give credit to Jeff and the other leaders, at Bill Mizell and others at the FDA, for, you know, really listening and trying their best to really steer what is a massive ship, you know, and a very difficult one to turn around. But I think, you know, it's in a much better place, and I think, you know, and I really, you know, thank them for that, and am very happy to have participated in the whatever role that I played in making that happen.
Yeah, I don't think you ever took off your shoe and pounded the table with it. It was always very measured, and
thanks.
And you've always data to back up your point. Where, just in your background a little bit, where did you grow up? I know you ultimately went to MIT, but you started at Case Western. How did you sort of find your way into the medtech world?
You know, it's interesting because when I was a little kid, like 5 years old, I sketched in a notebook and I was drawing inventions of, you know, I was really inspired by the Bionic Man.
I mean, was it?
And ideas. Yeah, exactly. And all those ideas of, you know, we can build them better, and, you know, all this, you know, sort of the idea of how technology could really, you know, enhance or improve people's lives. And I just always loved the idea, you know, just sort of totally fascinated with the wonder and the complexity of the human body and all the parts, and how does it, with this miraculous design of how it all works together. Just still to this day, it's just fills me with a lot of wonder and excitement. And so, you know, while that was there, I had other interests, and music was one of them. I actually entered college as a music major.
No kidding.
Yes, but very quickly switched to engineering. After I, you know, a couple of theory classes and a couple of instrument classes, I realized, oh my God, I can't spend 4 years doing this. I like music, but I don't like it that much. And, you know, just found my way to engineering and bioengineering, and you know, I've always been, you know, what attracted me to music was the creative aspects, and I think the opportunity to apply creativity to improving people's lives, I couldn't think of a better way or topic to apply it to. So I just love that idea, and so I was very drawn to it. That's why I went to medical school after engineering school, just to really learn about the body and learn about physiology, and that was a fantastic journey for me, always having a little bit of an engineering mind, you know, cause as I looked at things and a different lens, and, you know, being partially dyslexic, always sort of seeing, you know, the reverse image of the image, and, you know, sort of helps to see things that aren't there, and recognizing how many things we took for granted and we didn't really understand about medicine, that sort of really propelled me forward to believe that there's a great opportunity to create a career around building things that would make a difference. And so when I got my first job with Pfizer, as a technology analyst, I was very fortunate to be given an additional assignment by Hank McKinnell, who was the CFO at the time, that I should find out why, you know, our companies aren't inventing and innovating as much as they were when they were independent startups, and try to figure out a way to do it internally. And that led me down this path of identifying processes for innovation. And that was the sort of the origin of the what is now the biodesign process that we teach at Stanford.
Wow.
And then I utilized that same process in my own career inside of Pfizer as we created new products. But also when I started exploring Med 95, that same process was the core asset that NEA backed, John Neera, you know, and Bob Anderson wrote the first checks for ExploreMed on the basis that that methodology would be able to create new companies. And, you know, we've proven that that's the case, and we've been able to create a couple of really great big companies out of that. And, you know, they haven't all been successes, but we've had a few, and I think there's some more coming. And now it's great to see the students of biodesign at Stanford utilizing those same tools to create businesses and, you know, create technologies for patients as well. So, you know, so far so good.
What would you tell? Well, where was young Josh McCower drawing those pictures? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in, I was born in Massachusetts. And my parents were going to University of Massachusetts in Amherst at the time.
Oh, I did not know
that. Then we moved to the Connecticut area, then to the New York area. I spent most of my youth in the upper, sort of outside the city in the Rockland County area before I went off to college.
So you're a Northeast guy, which explains the willingness to step up and push back a little bit.
I guess so. Yeah.
Josh, I know one of the more recent projects, and I think probably will be one of the more successful projects to come out of Stanford, was Oculi. We had Michael Ackerman on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. What role did you have in putting that together?
Well, Michael was a fellow of Stanford BioDesign, and so we had the opportunity, and that original concept was sort of conceived within the BioDesign program at Stanford. And so during that time, I was his mentor and faculty member. And, but I don't in any way want to take away from the tremendous, insight and execution that Michael pulled together for that deal. I mean, I think it's incredibly remarkable, incredibly unique. He's an unbelievably talented guy, and he did something miraculous in a very short period of time, and really evolved and adapted that idea to an even more executable idea during the course of just a couple of years after it left BioDesign. So, I've been a mentor of Michael's, continued to be one. He seeks me out for various advice on strategy and technology from time to time. But again, I put it all to Michael. And of course, Ali Bevahani here at NEA was on the board, and I know contributed a lot to the development of that company. But my role was really just sort of being an advisor for Michael and helping him in any way I could.
Did you teach him how to be stealthy? Because he was pretty stealthy in keeping a lid on the idea. And even when I thought I had figured it out from a Stanford article, he advised me in my interview that, no, that was actually the old idea. We have a new idea that's even better.
Exactly. Well, I do think that there's an element of surprise that is important. And, I obviously executed in my own career as well. So perhaps he might pick something like that up. but again, he is a remarkable individual and a great entrepreneur and inventor, and actually did a great job as CEO of that early stage business. So, that's all him. That's all him. I mean, you can be a good mentor, but only if the mentee actually has got a lot going for him. And in this case, he's got the full package. I'm really impressed and proud of him.
That's great. Are you looking at ophthalmology deals, or do you leave that to Ali, or is it open to anybody?
Ali is our resident expert in ophthalmology here at NEA. So whenever anything comes in that domain, I of course send it over to him. But we as a team are very interested in ophthalmology projects and, look forward to participating in more of them as we go forward. And we just closed another investment in ophthalmology from that was originally founded in an incubator that we backed, a little business called Clair Vista. And that's a very exciting project. Also, Ali's on the board there, so it's a great, great new project in ophthalmology. So yes, we will still look, and we intend to invest in ophthalmology going forward.
Well, when we're done with this interview, Clair Vista was a guest on this week's OIS podcast, so make sure you check it out. Final question, what would you tell a slightly older Josh McCarver who's looking to get into med tech? What does the future of this industry look like in your eyes?
I think that it's funny because I just met with the new crop of fellows for this year's Stanford BioDesign class and, had exactly this comment, which is, look, whatever it was, it's not going to look the same, and you shouldn't expect it to look the same. I mean, things change, and the environment has changed, and it's going to change. So as you are an innovator, you've got to be responsive, you've got to be flexible, and so you can't use the same models and ideas and approaches exactly that we used before, but we need to be adaptive to the current environment. And the current environment is calling for the consumerization of healthcare. It's calling for lower cost, much more accessible technologies that really have still a similar impact. And so those can still be implants, but they need to be, there isn't going to be the $200 million checks being written for these projects right now if they have very, very long regulatory and reimbursement pathways. There needs to be much more thoughtful ways of executing right now. Maybe we'll be able to get back to that someday. But right now, the domain in which seems to have green lights over innovation for it are clear, and those involve much more straightforward and with a cost focus projects that span, you know, traditional medical devices and into consumer and health tech.
Great. Well, it's supposed to change. You're right. That's what innovation is all about. Thanks for for revisiting your history and for giving us a glimpse forward. I can't wait to see what you do at NEA.
Thank you very much, Tom. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Josh, thank you for joining us for this conversation today. For our listeners, I hope you enjoyed this visit with one of the more interesting and influential people in medtech innovation. And if you want to connect with more influences of innovation, go to OIS.net, register to attend our OIS at AAO conference on November 12th, and we'll see you in Las Vegas.
OIS is now accepting applications for presenting companies. Share your technology and clinical data with over 800 industry executives, investors, and key opinion leading ophthalmologists. To be considered for the Ophthalmology Innovation Showcase, apply online at www.ois.net/application.